Our next case this morning is O'Connor v. McKesson Corporation. The number is 207059. Ms. Brinkman, you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Beth Brinkman, and I'm appearing on behalf of McKesson. The federal officer removal statute was misapplied by the district court, and its remand order should be reversed. The statute provides for removal to federal court in just this kind of case. First, this is a case where McKesson is performing a government task that the government would otherwise need to perform itself. Indeed, the government did perform these tasks, logistics, acquisition, storage, and distribution of the medications itself, until it arranged for McKesson to take that responsibility on for the government. And the work is critical to the government's legal obligation to provide health care through its federal programs in Oklahoma. McKesson's work was performed pursuant to a series of government detailed specifications and under the direction and control of a contracting officer. Second, the claims here relate to McKesson's distribution of opioids to the federal health care programs in Oklahoma, and plaintiffs' attempt to disclaim that fails.
Yeah, so let me ask you about that. So, I mean, basically, the plaintiff says, listen, as far as all your federal work, the 17 point whatever percent of the federal opioids you're bringing into the state, we give you that. We're not going after that. We're not going to go after it. We lose on that as far as this case is concerned. We're only going to go after non-federal stuff. So if that's true, I mean, why can't they do that?
If I can for a moment, Your Honor, I want to step back and really discuss what the claim is here, and it'll make it very clear why they can't do that, and also why, in analogous circumstances, the Seventh Circuit and Baker rejected that argument. The Fourth Circuit and Express Scripts rejected that argument. The Northern District of Ohio, which was looking at this very PPV contract, also rejected that approach. The state claims it was injured by diversion caused by McKesson shipping into the state an excessive amount of opioids. They claim that that shipping caused the diversion because after those prescribed opioids were dispensed to patients in Oklahoma, this is after they're in the medicine cabinets in people's homes in Oklahoma. This is in paragraph 15 of their complaint. They allege that 65% of those go unused and often end up being diverted. That's their claim. But the opioids in those medicine cabinets that they allege were taken and then diverted into pills in the illicit market that created this excessive amount that they're basing their case on, those came from both federal and non-federal healthcare facilities. There's no means to trace back which of those pills that they claim created this excessive amount that were diverted came from non-federal healthcare or federal healthcare. So they can't disclaim that. It's very analogous to the Baker situation. This is the Seventh Circuit case where the plaintiffs were claiming injury from soil contamination. There was government contracting work over the years. There have been non-government commercial work. They were claiming injury from arsenic and lead. And they said, we're disclaiming the one company's contract with the federal government for Freon 12. We're disclaiming that. No, you know, we don't want this removed. No federal officer removal. But the company said, but our Freon 12 produced lead and arsenic. And in footnote 3 of Baker, the court went through this exact argument and said, you know, that's a question for merits. That's more than enough to meet the federal officer removal statute of relating to the action for the government.
Does your argument depend on the percentages, which is to say here it's 17.1%? What if it were 1% that was federal?
The Baker court addressed that issue also, Your Honor, and it suggested that perhaps if there was some de minimis amount, that would not cover it. But in that case, there were actually lower percentages on for both of the companies involved. At one, it was, I think, perhaps 20% and then 5 to 15% of the relevant time period they were talking about there. So it doesn't have to be, it has to be more than de minimis, I would say, Your Honor. But again, it's a significant amount here, and that is why we put it in our papers for removal to make that clear. I could give another example that I think would go back to Judge Carson's question about how they can't disclaim it here. So another claim of theirs is that the McKesson should have refused to ship some identified orders. Now, these are all orders that were prescribed by licensed physicians and ordered by licensed dispensaries. Plaintiff's argument is that part of McKesson's decision about whether to fill orders should have been based on their assessment of the overall amount that was going into the geographic area. They talk about this in many places in the complaint, but specifically in paragraph 75 to 76. They argue that McKesson was knowingly or should have known that they were shipping in more opioids than were medically necessary for that geographic region. That necessarily, again, includes, under their theory and their argument and their claim of injury, that it would include the amount of opioids that were in that area due to federal contracting order shipments. So they can't disclaim it under either of those. And the Baker case, as I said, is really helpful on this. I'd also point to two other cases.
The reason, counsel, could I just ask you, in light of the disavowal clause, what questions of federal law must be decided to resolve this case?
There's two federal defenses, and in federal officer removal, it's those federal defenses that are the federal questions that give rise to federal court jurisdiction, because it's a removal statute that's removing state law claims. Yes. The defenses are the federal contractor defense and a federal preemption defense. And the federal contractor defense is under the Boyle case. It's got three clear elements. The government has to set specification. The contractor has to meet them. And the government has to be aware of any risks that the contractor is aware of. Again, the other cases that I just referred to also recognize that there was a colorable federal contractor defense. You only need one and only need to be colorable, but there is a second one here also. There's a federal preemption defense under the Controlled Substances Act.
Well, this may call, at the risk of maybe you're repeating a point or two, if the disavowal clause limits the state's claims to non-federal distributions, how do these defenses come into play?
Your Honor, the claim is not carved up by distributions. They make this generic kind of boilerplate. We're disclaiming any federal question. We're disclaiming any federal
offer. Well, counsel, the clause says that the petition disavows any cause of action or claim for recovery related to opioids McKesson distributed to federal customers. So it does carve them out.
But it doesn't, the claim that they're making is for injury for government services they had to provide for emergency services and addiction services because of the total amount of prescription opioids that were shipped into Oklahoma. And their theory is because they were diverted after they were people medicine's cabinets, because they were there were too many shipped, they were then taken and diverted into the illicit market.
I understand your point, and you've made that point well. But I'm stuck on this language, claim for recovery related. Why doesn't that effectively limit their claim?
Because you can't parse it out. They claim an indivisible injury. There's no means of tracing it. It's like the arsenic.
Well, but counsel, it may be difficult to parse out, but isn't that a burden that they've assumed based on the theory of their petition?
No, they don't have any theory at all identified in which there is any way to take pills that are diverted and somehow identify their ultimate source. It's
are they required to specify how they're going to prove their case in the complaint once they've limited it to non-federal distributions? I mean, they're going to have to prove it. It may be hard, but that's the way they've chosen to plead it.
They haven't alleged any relationship between the level of distribution and the level of injury. And if the court looks to the Fourth Circuit in the Express Scripts case that was just decided this past year, we filed a 28J letter on that. They looked at this exact theory and they explained diversion can happen at any point in this. That was a Department of Defense contract about a mail order pharmacy, but the same arguments based on this total amount. And they said it's contradicted by the claim here and they can't disavow that. The Northern District of Ohio and the multi-district litigation looked at this exact statute in a tribal case and also said it's clearly acting under, it's related to, and they can't disclaim that because of the claim they're making about the injury and the remedy also that they're seeking to that. So if you look at the language of that, it isn't adequate to say that the theory here, their claim for recovery is because they were injured by diversion because of the total amount. And that total amount is what caused them these injuries. And there is no relationship between how much was distributed to a facility and several steps down the line, which of those pills were not diverted. It's not like you can say, you know, they shipped 23% and 23% were diverted. That's pure speculation. And those are merits questions.
And could I just,
a federal court should decide.
I've been puzzling over a related aspect of this, which is, of course, they're not the only distributors. And in fact, they're not the only contributors to the alleged crisis. I mean, we've got people who are doctors who are prescribing. We've got pharmacies that are selling. I mean, there are a lot of contributors here. And you're saying, well, it's hard to draw the line between federal and non-federal distributions as to your client, but wouldn't they have to draw the line between themselves and everyone else who may be contributing to the crisis?
My understanding, Your Honor, is that they're trying to hold liable for everyone under joint and several liability. But it's not just it's difficult for my client. Their claim, it's not just it's different, it's impossible. Their claim is based on this undifferentiated pool of pills that cannot be traced back. I see my time is about to expire. I'd like to save some time for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Breckenridge.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, Tillman Breckenridge on behalf of the state of Oklahoma. A lot of the discussion so far has revolved around the disavowal, and so I'll start with that. And it really requires and depends on McKesson directly mischaracterizing our claims. And so I want to clarify some of that. So, for instance, the statement that 65% of that our claim is that 65% of opioids were diverted after being in medicine cabinets, and that's the claim, definitely misstates our claims. Our claims are that McKesson hid suspicious orders, did not, and they are suspicious orders that may have come from that came from private pill mills and other private pharmacies. And so the notion that it only involves pills that were diverted after they were legitimately provided to people and put in their medicine cabinets is just simply untrue. Our claims also involve McKesson coaching pill mills on how to avoid their orders being tracked as suspicious. It involves McKesson telling its own employees not to use the word suspicious in emails as referring to particular orders so that they would not be flagged. So the notion that this is just some, you know, completely indivisible issue where McKesson just provided pills to people and then they diverted it later is just simply not representative of our claims. And so to the extent that we're talking about this from the standpoint of joint and several liability and indivisible injury, we agree that the injury is indivisible, but the conduct is not. McKesson's conduct is completely divisible. And so as an example, I would say, you know, a classic example of joint and several liability would be a fight. So let's say Mr. McKesson gets into a fight with someone we'll call victim. And let's even say that Mr. McKesson claims that the first punch was in self-defense. And maybe victim disagrees, maybe victim agrees, but victim says, okay, fine, I'll grant you that. Let's just pretend that first punch was in self-defense. But then you punched me, you broke my rib, and I started walking away. And then you and your buddy Bergen and your buddy Cardinal got together, and the three of you jumped me. And then you beat me to a pulp to the point that my injuries are indivisible. I had to go to the doctor, and all my medical bills are all together and all that stuff. That doesn't change the fact that the conduct itself is divisible. And the conduct here was divisible. And so what we did is we put in our petition that we're not going to claim on the conduct of the federal sales. And I will note that one big distinction between this and Baker is the fact that we use the word excessive, and McKesson uses the word excessive and then tries to really redefine the word excessive by saying that we're saying no pills and we're completely against opioids and pills must go away now. But just the opposite. Excessive carries within it the notion, the inherent fact that there are some appropriate sales. So inherent to this case is the requirement that we create some division and some recognition of the fact there's some baseline of sales that are fine, and then there's this set of excessive sales. And then so when we're putting aside that set of sales that are fine, we've stated in our petition that we're going to create this bucket of irrelevant sales, and we're going to go ahead and put the federal claims in that bucket of irrelevant sales, and we're going to prove our case based just on the excessive private sales.
Could I just ask, can you point us to a case in which a court has rejected federal officer removal due to a disclaimer or disavowal provision like the one we have here?
Off the top of my head, not. There are some cited in our brief from district courts. The only circuit case that I'm aware of that involved a disavowal was the Baker case. Express Scripts and the MDL case did not actually involve a disavowal. That's one huge distinction that's been left out here, is that the Express Scripts case necessarily involved federal sales because it wasn't a distributor. It was actually an agent of the government who went in and sold at TRICARE pharmacies. And then, of course, the MDL case was about sales to Indians, which was purely under federal contract. And it's really somewhat disappointing to see that as something that McKesson relies on, given the fact that in that opinion, the judge plainly stated that his case did not involve cases by state attorneys general, and expressly put that aside and said to the litigants, regardless of those policies, this case and this decision are limited to the facts of the two cases before me, which involve Indian tribes.
Well, would it be fair to say then that your argument consists of distinguishing cases, but you don't have an on-point case to support your position?
Well, I'd say there's no on-point case to support either position, because there's no directly on-point case that involves a direct disavowal of claims like this one here. There are district court cases that go both ways. The district court cases that go the other way from our position involve these kind of broad disavowals that don't go specific to exact conduct. And that's true in Baker. And then on top of that, in Baker and in these other cases, it involves conduct that is not that cannot be severed or anything like that, because Baker involved chemicals put into the streams and put into the ground during World War II as a government contractor forced at pain of criminal prosecution to do the work. And in that case, it really was a case of the less the better. It doesn't matter. All of it's bad. In this case, that's not what's happening here. Our claims are based on dividing up the conduct. And then when we divide up the conduct, there is plenty in the terms of private excessive sales to support our claims.
Let me just ask you on your public nuisance claim, how can the state litigate, and for that matter, how can a court adjudicate the public nuisance claim without considering the distribution to federal customers?
Well, Your Honor, I can just do that by taking a look at the giant size of excessive distributions of private to pill mills and looking at the conduct of coaching pill mills on how to avoid being considered suspicious, and the conduct of telling McKesson employees how to avoid flagging things as suspicious, and look at that conduct and say, you know what, regardless of all of the other pills that have been put out there that are either legitimate or not being considered, this giant excessive amount of opioids was clearly a cause of the incredible problems the state has had to mitigate.
Counsel, let me jump in here for a minute. It seems to me what you want to do is exclude the federal sales for purposes of proof, but you don't want to have to account for what those federal sales might do on damages. Your position is, listen, if I can get them on proof of the coaching and telling them not to use the word suspicious in emails and all these other things, then I can get them for the full measure of damages because they're going to be subject to some kind of joint and several liability. Is that where you're headed? So your position is I can carve them out as far as proof, but I'm still going to get those damages in the end. That's going to be my damage model is not going to be limited in the same way that my proof is.
Yeah, we do not plan for the damage model to be limited for the same way the proof is, just as in any joint and several liability case. So just as in the case of a fight, you know, that Mr. McKesson is responsible for the cloud of damages in the same way that Mr. Bergen and Mr. Cardinal are. And that's just how joint and several liability goes. But it
don't you think that Ms. Brinkman's client is going to want to have some type of defense based on, you know, hiding behind the cloak of the federal government who they're working for, that that's going to be part of their case?
Well, yes, but having a federal defense does not entitle one to being in federal court. And one important aspect of pointing that
isn't that the whole point of the federal officer removal statute, is that it is based on federal defenses. So do they have a federal defense on damages?
Well, first of all, I would disagree with the premise because that's just one aspect of the federal officer statute. But
it's still an aspect. So I'll amend my question to an aspect.
Yes. Well, and no, they don't have a federal defense. And even if they did, the result would be that we would then exclude the federal sales, and then we'd be back in the position of basically having it as if it were as if the disclaimer had been operative in the first place. So it would be somewhat circular, but they do not have a federal.
Let me stop you there. So in your world, there's no defense as far as defending against your damage argument relating to the 17 point whatever percent federal sales. They can't come in response to your damages and say, whoa, wait a minute, at least 17% of what we sold was pursuant to this federal contract that you disclaimed, and we shouldn't have to pay that.
Well, if they want to make that argument under Oklahoma law, then they can, but that's not a federal defense. That's really a defense of how pleading works under Oklahoma law and how the claim works under Oklahoma law. But in either event,
it's no defense at all if it didn't involve the federal government, is it? I mean, if it didn't involve the federal government, they can't raise it at all. I mean, you're having to, if it doesn't matter under Oklahoma law, why are you disclaiming it?
Well, we are disclaiming it so that we wouldn't find ourselves in the situation we are now, Your Honor, where McKesson is making up an argument that somehow, some way, a light touch of the federal government allows them to bring their case to the federal courts when they completely lacks the control at issue. And that, I want to come back around to Judge Matheson's question to point out that there is no federal defense. Because, you know, as we've discussed in the briefs, the preemption defense, which is wholly not colorable in any way. And then on top of that, the federal contractor defense is not colorable. And I would point the court, you know, to the extent that McKesson would like the court to, you know, decide this case based on Fourth Circuit law rather than Tenth Circuit law. These Fourth Circuit cases involving failure to warn, as my friend on the other side stated, have three criteria. One is that the government states a requirement. The second is that they fill the requirement. So in these failure to warn cases, the Navy said, like Sawyer, for instance, the Navy said, you have to give the X, Y, and Z warnings. And then the second prong is that they have to show that they gave the warnings. And McKesson did not put in any evidence that they did the second part. So the first part, as compared to warnings, the first part on suspicious sales is to report to the suspicious sales to the government. And then the second part, I mean, well, this, the first part is that the government provides the suspicious sales opportunity. And then the second part is that they actually report suspicious sales to the government. And then the government says, fill them anyway. There's no evidence in the record that they did that. So I don't think that there's a federal defense at all. And even to the extent that they're arguing on damages that there's that we've disavowed federal claims, so therefore damages should be cut by 17.1%. That's an issue of Oklahoma pleading law. That's not an issue of federal law, nor is it a federal defense. And if unless the court has any further questions, I'll submit.
Well, I'll ask you another question because you've got 2 minutes. this is a slightly different one. This has to do with your argument on the first element of the three officer removal elements. Why is the contract, the PPV contract, more like an off-the-shelf fuel supply agreement, as in the Baltimore Sun and San Mateo cases, than the military procurement contracts in the Winter, Isaacson, Sawyer, Agent Orange situation? We haven't heard anything on that this morning. What do you say about that?
Well, I say it's far closer to the Baltimore case than it is to the provision of highly specified materials in Winter and other cases. So to give you an example, I'll actually quote from the Baltimore case at page 464. Defendants emphasize the agreements, one, set forth detailed fuel specifications that required compliance with specified American Society for Testing and Material Standards and compelled NEXCOM to have a qualified independent source analyze the products for compliance. Two, authorize the contracting officer to inspect delivery site and operations. Three, establish detailed branding and advertising requirements. This sounds exactly like the list in the reply brief that that McKesson stated. And then at the end of that that paragraph, the court says the cited provisions seem typical of any commercial contract. They are incidental to sale and sound in quality assurance. Incidental to sale and sound in quality assurance. That is that is exactly applicable to this to the list in the reply brief. And that puts this case far closer to the Baltimore case than to any of the cases in which the courts have found federal officer removal. And I see my time is up unless there are any further questions. All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Brinkman, rebuttal.
Thanks. Yes, I have 4 points I think would be very helpful, so I'm going to go straight to them. First of all, I really want to correct and urge the court to look at that case in the Northern District of Ohio involving the tribe. I want to correct that. We are correct. That was not just federal sales, as opposing counsel suggested. At least 22% were federal. There were commercial non-federal sales. In fact, there was a motion for reconsideration filed. They tried to say it was de minimis. The record's clear on that. The Express Scripts case in the Fourth Circuit also had the same theory of the pool of opioids in Arlington. And in that community, there were federal and non-federal.
Did it have a disavowal?
Yes, like they didn't have it in the complaint, Your Honor, but in both instances, they argued to the court they were disavowing it. In the district court case in Ohio, they actually, in their motion for reconsideration, they put that in writing all. But in the Fourth Circuit, they also said this case has nothing to do with the federal contract. It's not in our complaint. You know, we're not seeking anything for that. So it wasn't in the complaint, but it was the same type of argument.
But the circuit court doesn't talk about that I've seen.
It talks a little bit about how there is a paragraph in there, Your Honor, where it talks about the effort to say this. It says Arlington insists work was required. It argues that its amended complaint did not even mention the distribution of opioids to veterans, the DOD contract, or the operation of the TPOMM. Its allegations, according to Arlington, have nothing to do with DOD or its program. That's in the Fourth Circuit opinion.
It's a different disavowal, but I don't want to use your time. Go ahead.
Thank you. It's not in the complaint, Your Honor, but it's the same theory. They're trying to say our case is not going to have to do with that. I wanted to just also say they may have other arguments about, you know, their alleged pill mills and all this, but it takes one claim to remove. Every single argument doesn't have to be. We've more than amply made that claim here. And also our defense can also involve, they say we should look to prescribing practices and all that. And here we have this relationship with the federal government that we would invoke also. Removal isn't about the merits. It's about what court is going to decide it. The Supreme Court's made clear we don't need, a defendant doesn't need to win the case before they can have it removed. My time is up, Your Honor. If you would like, I could also cite you to places in the appendix that respond to your last question about the direction and control. Very quickly, Your Honor, the specifications are at appendix 161 to 162. In the contract, the PPV contractor requires 30-minute confirmation, 97% fill rate, next day delivery. And then for the direction and the control at appendix 139, it talks about the monthly on-site visits and quarterly meetings with the contract officer. And then appendix 204, it talks about the what to do if there appears that there could be diversion. You can't unreasonably delay the shipment. The information has to be reported to the contracting officer in 48 hours, and the federal contracting officer has the ultimate authority.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Thank you to both of you for your arguments this morning. The case will be submitted, and counsel are excused.